Welcome to The Global Journalist on KBIA. This program is dedicated to the idea that mid-Missourians, indeed most Americans, are interested in international news. My name is Roger Gafke of the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm substituting in the role of moderator and host for Stuart Lurie, my colleague at the Missouri School of Journalism. We have two topics on our program today, both from the Western Hemisphere. As you would expect, an examination of former President Carter's visit to Cuba, and an update on issues facing Mexico and their impact on the United States. In Mexico, President Fox promised what was called a merciless war on drug barons, but a piece in yesterday's Los Angeles Times by one of our guests suggests much remains before that promise will seem to be fulfilled. Our guests today are Nancy San Martin, foreign correspondent of the Miami Herald. She joins us this morning from Miami. Ignacio Rodriguez Reyna, the associate managing editor of El Universal in Mexico City, and Mark Feynman, reporter with the LA Times, who has followed President Carter during his trip to Cuba, and he joins us from Havana. Let's begin with the former president's trip to Cuba. Mark, I've seen two descriptions of the president's trip this week. It's called, on the one hand, an historic trip, and on the other hand, it's said that it'll make no difference in American policy toward Cuba. Can both of those perspectives be right? How do you see it?
Absolutely. I think that mirrors the contradictions, the many contradictions in the relationship. I do believe that it is historic, and it certainly is playing out that way here on the ground in Havana. His live, uncensored speech to the Cuban nation, which he delivered in Spanish, obviously was unprecedented. His trip itself is unprecedented since the revolution, a former U.S. president stepping foot on the island. And at the same time, I think that there's a general awareness on both sides of the Florida Straits that you know, this is such a complex and old relationship that it's going to take more than just one trip to change it.
Nancy, what has been the reaction, as you've been able to judge, from the Cuban community in your town?
I would agree with Mark on his analysis here. In Miami, it's also been a somewhat of a, you know, where do we go from here? The reaction here has been somewhat muffled. I mean, folks, I would describe as, on the one hand, kind of optimism, though that's laced with skepticism. And on the other hand, a kind of, well, this is just another trip. It doesn't really mean a whole lot. It'll be the same thing, you know, 20 years from now. Nothing will change until Fidel Castro is gone. But it's interesting to see that there has been no vocal, you know, rallies or any kind of vocal opposition to the visit, which is somewhat different from previous years, I would say.
And Ignacio, what does this story look like from your perspective in Mexico City? A non-issue? Well, an importance? What?
Well, yes, of course it's an issue, especially because probably you are aware that the Mexican foreign policy is shifting focus. Mexico usually has a very strong tradition of supporting the Cuban regime. Actually, one was one of the countries that doesn't really break relationships with the Cuban regime, and with the arriving of the president Vicente Fox to power, it begins to change. And now we just passed a very huge diplomatic crisis with Cuba, and now we are Mexicans that I would say that a large portion of Mexicans didn't like this new policy, this new foreign policy, and now we are seeing them seeing how the President Carter for us was incredible to see the American flag in the back of the room where they're held in the press conference. So in Mexico, like, it's been discussing because now, well, the American former American president has been in Cuba, giving support to the one of the oldest political system, and Mexico is retracting from this position. So we are following very closely.
Let me ask about the embargo and the sanctions, the economic sanctions. A report overnight that the president, when he speaks, Monday, is likely to toughen those sanctions and all. For either Nancy or Mark, where is the economic benefit flowing from the United States continuing to have those sanctions? Who's benefiting from that? And, of course, the reverse side of that question is, surely there must be tremendous economic pressure to open that market.
Well, from Cuba's perspective, obviously the embargo has been the centerpiece of complaints about the relationship by the government, by the people. The sense that for four decades, the American products can't be sold here. At least that's the perception. As far as how much the embargo is actually hurting, one of the comments that Mr. Carter made in his speech to the nation was quite interesting. He said it passed a lot of people by, but he said that it from his perspective, he didn't believe that the blockade, as they call it here, was actually causing suffering for the Cuban people because they could buy cheap medicines, for example, from Mexico. They can access markets, and in fact, they're doing more than $1 billion worth of trade with Europe. It is more expensive. The head of the company, the Cuban company that imports food goods for the Cuban economy, had a press conference a couple of days ago during former president's visit, and he made the point that the embargo is hurting U.S. companies worse than it's hurting Cuba because it denies U.S. companies a nearby and potentially fairly lucrative market. What isn't widely known, but has been going on for the last 6 months or so, is Cuba is actually purchasing food directly from U.S. manufacturers for cash under a law that was signed by President Clinton in the year 2000. So there is some flow of goods, and I think for most Cubans, that's one of the real key issues, is to open up this flow between the two countries because of the proximity, if nothing else.
Yes, in terms of who stands to gain specifically, I would say that the U.S. farming community stands most to gain in terms of lifting the embargo. As Mark mentioned, there has been some sales that was specifically as a result of deemed to replenish the food that was lost during Hurricane last year. But the other thing I wanted to mention about the embargo is one of the things that has been constantly pointed to is that the exile community here essentially has been put to blame, for lack of a better term, in terms of keeping the embargo in place. And today we published a report on a poll that actually shows that the Cuban American community is evenly divided on that issue now, that they are supporting perhaps more than ever maybe another look at whether or not the embargo has worked and whether it ought to be, toughened. So I think that's also an interesting outcome that this poll is coming out.
That's fascinating, Nancy, because one of the things that Jimmy Carter said during his speech, he cited these polls that show the overwhelming majority, I think it's 70%, mm-hmm. of American people in general throughout the country believe that the embargo should be lifted. It was one of the centerpieces of his speech.
Mm-hmm. Well, this poll specifically looks at the Cuban-American community, and I agree that it is fascinating that the outcome is that there's an even split, and I would say that 10 years ago that would not be the case.
Again, do either of you know where there would be economic pressure other than the Cuban-American community to keep that in place? Is there any other segment of our American economic society that's benefiting from that? I don't know of any. I just wonder where the pressure to keep it on comes from.
Well, Go ahead.
From the American side, I don't think there is. In fact, quite the opposite. The U.S. business community has been fairly strident, increasingly strident in pressuring Congress, certain congressmen in particular, to gradually pass legislation that gradually eases the embargo and opens it up. I can't see how there'd be any economic benefit to anyone in the U.S. for having this island embargoed.
Yeah, from the business community, I would say that's true. That you know, I know of none who are pressuring to keep it in place. However, you know, from the conservative component, I mean, this has become a real issue of principle, or you know, do we lift it and in essence recognize a government that we've been fighting with for more than four decades? So there are conservatives in Washington who are adamant supporters of the embargo.
Well, exactly, and some of those conservatives are in the State Department. I think Nancy's absolutely right that it's an ideological and political critical mass that has continued to support the embargo decade after decade, president after president, administration after administration. It's really only a recent phenomenon that there's been a countervailing force from the U.S. business community. For years, there was no such counterbalance to that strong political component of the embargo.
What are the tactics regarding travel to Cuba now, since that's forbidden, but don't lots of Americans go off to Mexico City to get a visa, or to the Bahamas, or Montreal or somewhere and go in, and only occasionally penalties issued against us? I thought Nancy, in your paper, I saw a piece that somebody who took his father's ashes down to be spread in Cuba got a $5,000 fine for doing it or something.
Yeah, there have been a number of cases where people traveling back, and in most of these cases, I would say generally it's targeted Americans as opposed to Cuban Americans who also use the third country route to get there, where they've, you know, gone after these people for traveling. And mostly it appears to be more of a message, you know, that this is still the law and you're breaking the law. But no real substance there in terms of, it's at random, it seems. It's not as if they target any particular type of individual. They don't tend to touch the business community at all. There have been a number of business executives who travel constantly to Cuba to see what the prospects are for the future, and they certainly have not been targeted.
Now, do either of you guys get hassled when you come and go?
I should add, Nancy's right, but the corporate executives that have come in and out of here, most of them do travel under Treasury licenses. It's a cumbersome process, but you apply to the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control. You get a license. It has some restrictions, how much money you can spend per day while you're here. But it is used politically from time to time, and who gets those licenses and who doesn't. It's a restriction, but it does legitimize and legalize your travel down here. For journalists, there is no such restriction. Under Clinton, I believe it was, there were changes in the rules that permitted journalists to travel freely between the two countries. I mean, we have to get Cuban visas in order to come in and work as working journalists, but there are no such restrictions on journalists. There are some exemptions to the travel ban.
Ignacio, I want to come back to you for just a moment. While we've had this now, 45 or so year old strained relations with Cuba, how significant is Mexico and the Cuban economic relationship, even given the tensions that have come up here lately? I suspect you must be pretty good economic partners. The flow must be pretty
substantial. Well, actually, yeah, we have a lot of a commercial exchange. You know, a lot of Mexican businessmen were investing in Cuba, but the home Burton restriction also hits this change. You know, there used to be kind of around 500 firms involved exchanging trade. But since the Holmes rule became law, and some Mexicans were sanctioned with, they were not allowed to enter the United States anymore once the American government realized that they were doing business with Cuba. I think there's been some impact I have in mind a case, very important case, a huge company from Mexico tried to invest in the local telephone company in Cuba. Actually, they were in a joint venture with a firm from Italy, and well, you know, the Mexican businessman has to withdraw all his investment because of the sanctions applied by the American government. It's been still going on, especially in some common products like pharmaceutical stuff and in the construction industry. It's been going on. But certainly, there's been a limit with the American law.
Mark, a final question on this topic to you then. You started by observing the historic character of the visit, but pointing out that it won't be an instantly transforming consequence. What would you expect to see now over the next month or year or so?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, when it comes to the U.S.-Cuban relationship, and in fact, when it comes to change in Cuba itself, it's been described to me by several wise people as a series of incremental steps, and clearly, Mr. Carter's visit has been a significant step along that road. One thing we haven't spoken about was the issue of democracy and human rights and Mr. Carter's call for freedom live on government TV with Mr. Castro sitting right in the front row at Havana University the other night. And that will have some resonance. Will it immediately translate into change? No, clearly not. But just as this process seemed to have begun with Pope John Paul II's trip here 4 years ago, this is another important step along the road. There have been others, the baseball game between the Baltimore Orioles and the Cuban All-Star team down here. They're steps in a process. I don't think there's likely to be any immediate impact, certainly not with Mr. Bush's speech scheduled in Florida, and by all accounts, he's expected to take, as you said, a very hard line on Cuba. And it will show probably in years, not in months. And one will look back on Mr. Carter's trip as a significant step along that road.
I did notice that you quoted Mr. Carter. One of the quotes from him in one of your pieces was, gee, among the things we have in common, music and baseball. And I thought, ooh, that's a pretty interesting foundation on which lots of things can build.
Indeed. And in fact, under this people-to-people cultural exchange that's been going on over the course of the last several years, there are personal relationships, very close personal relationships that have been building up that are extra political. But a lot of people say that that's how a relationship is built, is that it's from the ground up, from the people up to the governments. One doesn't know if that actually is going to be the case with Cuba and the United States, but it's certainly a compelling theory.
Nancy, do you see any different scenario unfolding in the next year or so in the future?
Well, I think what this trip has done is really provided a tremendous boost for the moderates here in Florida, and it's also given Cubans in on the island something to really talk about and self-reflection, I think. The fact that his speech was not only broadcast on Cuban television and radio, but also that the Cuban media covered the event and specifically mentioned the Project Varela, the signature campaign, petition drive for
yes,
a referendum, is something that's never happened. I mean, this is really a groundbreaker. And even though the mention was limited, Cubans who saw the speech know exactly what Carter said. For the moderates here in the United States, particularly the Cuban American community, this provides something to hold on to, something to point to and say, here's someone whom we respect, who talks about human rights, and is recognized as the global leader in terms of human rights, and he's with us. We had a conference here in March in Miami, specifically about this issue and specifically about lifting the embargo, and 300 people, primarily Cuban Americans, showed up. This is something, again, that would not have happened years ago. And there was a protest, but it was less than 24 people outside, and it lasted for maybe 20 minutes, and then they were gone. So I think there is change. I think it'll be slow, and it'll be incremental steps, but this provides a basis to continue to move forward.
Let's move to our other topic now and get Ignacio back into the conversation here, as well as I want Mark, you to make some comments about the piece I referred to at the opening about your report on the anti-drug campaign and so forth. There looked like to me a couple of threats in Mexico, one from the drug organizations, the other from rebel groups, threats in terms of the president's administration or something. Which one of those is greater now?
Well, I wouldn't say that you can really take now seriously these threats. You know, the guerrilla here, the local guerrilla, it's been now very diminished. They don't have really great movements. They had been very quiet, especially after the elections, the 2000 years. You know, there was a kind of a huge consensus among people saying, well, we decide that the democratic way is the way that we want to change the Mexican political system. And now, of course, there remains several different and small groups in the mountains of the southern Mexico or the different states, but I wouldn't say that they have local support. No, and they have a very limited support in specific areas, but they don't have any specific influence on the rest of the society.
Has President Fox taken some steps to deal with the fundamental quality of life issues there that would diminish the appeal of rebels?
No, not really. Well, you know, the President Fox is really focusing on the macroeconomic changes, and he's been trying to push forward economic policy to create new jobs, to attract investment, foreign investment especially, to create, to keep the pattern that we used to have on economic issues several years ago. No, but I think the key factor is the Mexican people really don't like the violence and to guerrilla, to the armed people, to be the force for pushing the change. I think that there are several problems, local problems, and I think we will see very, very dramatic political conflicts, especially between Congress and President. And the President is realizing that he really doesn't have the power to change the Mexico structure and the Mexico dynamics without negotiating with the Congress, which is now the strongest political power in Mexico. I think it's a very, very interesting phenomena here in Mexico. For the first time, I would say a couple of years ago, the Congress is really working as a Congress, which is incredible here in Mexico.
Let me bring Mark back into the conversation, and would you make some comments or some perspective about the piece that I referred to yesterday? The version I saw said deadly messages to Mexico.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, but I'm going to
which looks like a terrible threat.
Question. Well, yeah, but I'm going to end it with a question I have for Ignacio.
Yes.
Clearly, what that refers to, of course, is the power, the brutality, and the corrosive elements involved in the multi-billion-dollar drug trade. For those very few who don't know, Mexico is the key transshipment point for principally cocaine, also marijuana and heroin, coming from South America up to the States to feed the American market. And through the process of that, it has created or plugged into border smuggling families that have become virtual cartels through the years. And they have defied a series of Mexican administrations. One of the reasons for that, I'm sure Ignacio will agree, is the extent to which they've corrupted state institutions, principally the police, even the attorney general's offices of various states, and to some extent the federal.
Now, are you
even the Mexican army.
See, we've got a couple of minutes left. I want to come back to your question there, so I need a summative statement. Your assessment, though, is not much progress has been made yet. Is that true?
That's right, up until now. But it's absolutely clear that Fox is trying to do something about this and has convinced the Americans that he is. And what the story you're referring to is about were some very significant recent arrests of the family leaders of the Arellano Felix cartel in Tijuana. From Ignacio's point of view, whether you think this is truly a sincere effort on Fox's part to crack down on these powerful corrosive cartels?
Yeah, well, I think the President Fox has a political will to try to attack this kind of organization, very huge and powerful, this organization of cartels of drugs. But I would say that you are right, absolutely. The corruption remains one of the main obstacles to try to crack down all this drug trafficking to our United States. There's been successful and I think a great success, detentions, like they were trying to hit in the middle of the cartel Arellano Felix, but I think the drug trafficking organization has been changing, and now they have a different structure. They are smaller, they are more sophisticated, and I think I wouldn't say that there is going to be a real major change right now in the drug trafficking scenario.
I think perhaps we'll leave it at that. The last word as our time expires here. Our guests today have been Nancy San Martin, foreign correspondent for the Miami Herald, Ignacio Rodriguez Reina, the associate managing editor of El Universal in Mexico City, and Mark Feinman, reporter for the LA Times, who joined us from Havana. To my three colleagues, thank you for this conversation and these insights today. My name is Roger Gaffke of the Missouri School of Journalism. Thank you for listening.